Welcome to Stir the Pots. And first, I want to ask you, where did you start baking bread?
I guess I'd have to say I really started baking bread in the kitchen of my UC Berkeley co-op apartment. I was working in restaurants in Berkeley. Gotten interested in bread because I ate a lot. I had also bought Elizabeth David's English Bread and Yeast Cookery, which I read a lot while I was in Europe, sort of determined to learn to bake bread. So at the time, I was sort of finishing up an aborted an abortive career at UC Berkeley. I started trying to figure out how to bake bread.
And of course, you went on to the famed Chez Panisse restaurant. And
well, I was already working at Chez Panisse. I just wasn't working in as a baker. I guess around in 1975, I started working at Chez Panisse in the dining room as a busboy, and sometimes as a dishwasher. And then when I came back from that trip for a while, I worked as a cook in the kitchen. Because I had been interested in cooking and had, hung out a lot in the kitchen trying to learn to be helpful, but the restaurant didn't do its own baking. So then I was sort of baking as a hobby, and at the same time, the quality of the bread that we could get for the restaurant was declining, and the quality of the bread that I was making eventually started to improve to the point where, by somebody's estimation, Alice's or whose ever, those two curves crossed, and so Alice asked if I would bake the bread for the restaurant.
And how did you decide that it was time to start a bakery, and what was the turning point when you knew that your bread was ready for the market?
Well, ready for the market. It wasn't quite that sort of calculation. When I was baking bread at the restaurant, I had these kind of, well, for me anyway, sort of tremendous kinds of experiences because I was, besides being a baker, I was an experienced busboy. So there were times when I would bake bread in the morning and then a busboy would be sick. So Alice would call and say, "Steve, can you come in and fill in as busboy?" So I would, be working as busboy, and one of the, main things you do as a busboy is bring people bread. And so I would bring people bread, and then people would say, "Wow, where'd this bread come from?" And then I'd say, "Well, I made it." And so, I mean, that's which is, not the sort of typical thing that happens between a busboy and a restaurant patron, and certainly was pretty unusual in 1979. So it was pretty clear that people really liked the idea that somebody had gone to a lot of trouble to try and make bread carefully. And most of the bread that was available wholesale at the time was clearly not made very carefully. Seven ovens all over the restaurant on both floors, and I would, be baking bread in all of them. And while I'm baking bread, the exhaust fans can't be on, so so it's kind of a, it created it, the restaurant was designed when the cafe was built, the restaurant was designed with a pastry section that had these two little tiny deck ovens in it, and they're very nice. And somehow the idea was when we decided to start baking bread that somehow I was going to bake all this bread in these two little ovens. That would have taken a really, really long time. So anyway, it was clear that there were a lot of people who wanted better bread. The restaurant really, was getting busier and busier, needed more and more bread, and to make it inside the restaurant was really stretching, the ability of the restaurant to accommodate that operation. So it became just kind of a foregone conclusion, that I would open a bakery. And Pat Curtin, who worked as a cook at Chez Panisse for a long time, had also been a baker. She and I thought about, becoming partners and doing a bakery, and looked a little bit, but nothing ever really quite worked out as far as finding a place and getting it together and committing to do it and getting money together, sort of all at the same time, until my wife just said, "Why don't we just do it together? We'll be partners." And we already were, partners in a sense. So I figured
there weren't too many competitors.
This was 1983. That really at the time all there were in this area were huge wholesale bakeries and little tiny retail bakeries. There were people who really were apprehensive about whether a small wholesale bakery could work, because the mindset was that, you know, people who buy bread for a restaurant or a store need to pay nothing for bread. You know, restaurants give it away, so they want to pay nothing for it. Bread had become sort of this, you know, wholesale, on a wholesale level, had become this sort of commodity, which wasn't looked to for any particular quality. Kind of like American beer, you know, a bread would distinguish itself by standing out just a tiny bit, you know, by virtue of the barest calculation. Well, we'll actually ferment this loaf a little bit, and then we'll call it, you know, special sour, you know, but it's just like turning the dial on the machine, the barest increment, you know, just like, you know, maybe a bit mass market American beer will try and distinguish itself for flavor by using a tiny bit more barley or a tiny bit of barley instead of rice. You know, they're just these calculated industrial recalibrations. So there really wasn't, you know, good bread being made on a wholesale level. So we didn't really feel like we had competitors. It was just a question of whether people would be willing to pay a little bit more than they had been paying. We were actually kind of surprised by how long it took to really happen in our particular neighborhood. I mean, it was, you know, for 5 years before really anybody came along who seemed to think that they could, you know, try and do the same thing on a wholesale basis. It was really kind of odd. You know, there were streets in the Bay Area where we would have, you know, accounts at five, we would be delivering bread to five consecutive stores on the same street because they all wanted good bread, and the only choice was either us or. It was actually kind of a relief when other bakeries started opening, maybe focusing their attention on either geographic areas that we didn't serve or a type of bread that we didn't make, you know, so because it was kind of odd being the only source for a certain class of a really common
wholesale or retail.
Yeah, we've always been our intention always was to be a wholesale bakery. I mean, I was baking bread in a restaurant, and my friends had restaurants and, you know, stores, and I mean that was what made it, because I wasn't really entrepreneurially oriented. I was perfectly happy working at Chez Panisse. I mean, it was a dream job. It was really a matter for us, opening the bakery was really a matter for us of filling a need that a community was kind of expressing really strongly. So, and that community was the food community of the Bay Area, you know, which was, you know, really looking at everything it was using and trying to figure out how to progress, you know, to using better ingredients, to producing more authentic and satisfying versions of the food that was being served to people.
And what sort of a description can you give your bread? I mean, is it an American bread, or is it a twist on European methods and styles of bread?
Well, we make a lot of different kinds of breads. Some of them are, you know, what you associate more with American-style baking. Certainly, at the outset, most of them were more inspired by European-style baking, particularly at the time. I mean, nobody was even really, for the most part, using stone hearth deck ovens commonly in this country, and certainly there was very little in the way of big crusty hearth loaves being served in restaurants. I mean, it was either baguettes or rolls, really. So in that sense, and that was a more European thing. So we're not really called upon to define ourselves really, to define ourselves very much, because we have, you know, a product that's there that people can decide if they want, and it's pretty easy to get a hold of and pretty easy to tell what it's like.
No, because I talked to some bakers, one in particular in Australia, and we kind of had a, not an argument, but we talked about what artisan means, and I asked, do you think it's a word that's overused and abused, and do you think there's bakeries that fit the bill of being artisan, or do you think it's just really a selling point to sell their bread?
Well, it's certainly, and what was this baker's position?
Well, he has a website actually in Australia, and he's baked in different bakeries, and right now he's trying to put it together an association in Australia style way rather than what's, you know, the real industrial baking, which is really, I guess, the powerhouse behind baking in Australia.
Yeah. Well, there's, I mean, it's certainly a term that has gotten overused, and it I forget who I was talking to just in the last day or two. You know, there was a really clear example of a bakery really overtly calling itself an artisan bakery, and it was a bakery that was full of machines. And the idea, you know, being that now the industry has gotten to the stage where there are, where there is machinery that is, you know, designed to make, you know, to be able to accommodate a wider range of levels of fermentation and levels of and different textures of dough, because those are, you know, some of the characteristic things that the standard industrial machinery wouldn't accommodate. And so, you know, so that machinery is marketed as being machinery to allow artisan bread to be mass produced. So, you know, so that to me is definitely a, you know, kind of a misnomer. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the term started being attached to bread baking really at a very specific point when the very early in the life of the Bread Bakers Guild of America, when we were, but you know, several of us who were among the first people to, you know, participate in that organization, were trying to figure out what, you know, how to define what the Bread Bakers Guild was going to stand for. And that term, although at the time I think we probably, at least some of us, felt as though it was very likely to become overused and get co-opted, I think, you know, we still felt as though in its actual meaning it really meant what we wanted it to mean, which was, you know, people making bread, people who have spent a lot of energy learning how to make bread well, putting their energy into making bread well, and sort of mechanizing it to the least possible degree. And one of us, Noel Comas from Tomcat, actually went through a period where he, you know, was very open to the idea of industrializing his operation more, if he honestly felt that the same results or even better results could be achieved. So he put a lot of time into determining whether that was the case. And I think he went into it rather, you know, feeling as though he probably was going to end up feeling as though it was a good thing to do because of the advances in technology of the machinery, and came away from it deciding that no, that it really was not the same thing as having people make bread. You know, it just...
Yeah, I interviewed him, and I actually saw his factory and was, I don't know, I had mixed feelings about what I thought of the end product, you know? But he was really honest about what he said, about how he felt, and, you know, he said, well, there's plenty of other people out there baking, so they can really make their choice. So
yeah.
I think it's a democratic sort of thing, you know, it's the customer decides.
Yeah, and that's the great thing about bread also, is that one of the things that is great for us, this is maybe slightly diverging, but when you talk about democratization and bread, it's one area where, example, absolute best of something really doesn't have to cost all that much money. You know what I mean? Like, if you really want the absolute best, you know, caviar or wine or chocolate or something like that, you're really in a whole different cost realm from typical wine or chocolate for a segment that can, you know, that can.
Well, I've been talking a lot to people regarding how in Europe, I was just in Paris last year, and in different parts of France and Switzerland. And I really love how there's a bakery in each neighborhood. And that's what America really lacks.
Yeah.
Though we make really fantastic bread here, there's really good bakers. there's just not that neighborhood bakery.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm sure San Francisco has a lot more than New York does, but I mean, we have our local guys, but they're like, you got to go to Manhattan to get a decent loaf of bread.
Yeah.
The reason because of the skills of bakers, industrialization, or gee, I don't know. It's just too expensive to open a bakery.
Well, it's fairly expensive to open a bakery. I haven't really thought through the economics of it. I mean, we were always were going to be a wholesale bakery, but you know, one guy baking bread for 4 a.m. and noon, and a retail only bakery, I think, is probably a pretty challenging thing to do, because you know, if you're going to sell, you know, I don't know, 2,000 loaves of, I mean, with 2,000 or $2,000 or $3,000 worth of bread every day, then, you know, you're kind of limited to, you know, I mean, how many people can be working there? So you're going to, you know, you're going to sell about $500,000 worth of bread a year, maybe, you know, so if you got 6 people working there and paying rent and, you know, I think it's challenging. And I think also probably, you know, the thing is, if you have a good bakery, probably other people, you know, who are a little bit farther away than just the neighborhood want your bread. So there tends to become a...
Noel Comessa told me bread grows.
Yeah, right, exactly. I mean, because we're starting off from a situation of having a lot of people spread out over a lot of area without there being little bakeries everywhere. So, you know, if somebody were to figure out a way to put down, a really good bakery within every, you know, square half mile or something, a good little neighborhood bakery, then it would probably, you know, you'd probably eliminate that. But,
well, I think the thing is, in Europe, it's just so inherent in their culture to have that.
Well, they already have those little bakeries. I mean, they physical
plants. And here now people are opening like cafes within a bakery to make the ends meet. Or what do you primarily use to ferment your bread? Sourdoughs, or is it hybridish, or what do you guys do?
We have a really wide range. We have several different sour cultures. Some, you know, I mean, well, I don't know. If, maybe saying cultures is suggests more absolute knowledge than we actually have. We have different types of starters, you know, rice starter, solid, which is a liquid starter, a solid whole wheat starter that we leaven our levain with, a couple of different liquid levain type, you know, slurry consistency starters. We leaven some breads with yeasted pouliche. We have other breads that are more of a directly leavened with yeast, but with long and addition of a pâte fermentée. So there's no one way that we leaven everything. We don't really work from any kind of master dough system. I mean, there are very few bread doughs that we make that get made into very many different things at all. It's, you know, each one's kind of unique. I mean, we might make a large and a small walnut levain, But that walnut levain is not the same levain dough as our regular panel levain. It's slightly different. You know, we might and which is different from the levain dough that we use for our olive bread.
Yeah, because I've seen a lot of people where they'll use a standard dough and then just mix in stuff.
Yeah, well, you know, and that's I don't know that there's anything wrong with that. It's just not the way we developed. I mean, I imagine it has, you know, certain efficiencies to it.
Well, you've traveled to Europe, I always noticed the differences in types of bread, the flavors, that there really is a flavor palette that's completely different from one style to the other. Do you find the same thing?
Well, that's what we try to accomplish with our breads. We try for our goal, I think, in as much as we have any particular goal for the breads, is really for them to individually really kind of represent something that is, you know, special and unique, rather than each being a variation on a single theme.
Mm-hmm. And who are your competitors today that you kind of like, oh, wow, I wish I could do that, what he's doing or she's doing?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess I wish I could, I wish we here could as dependably make Panel Levin that has all the characteristics that that seem to be really typical of Poilin's Panel Levin. You know, we are ours. Is, you know, that to me is sort of the gold standard, or has been, although I haven't had it for a few years. But, you know, I mean, with each, I guess I don't know that we have, I mean, that's probably the only one as far as looking to a specific other place at a specific thing they're doing and saying, we wish we knew how to do that. I think in our case, it's more of a matter of having an ideal, having an idea, having a goal for each of our breads, and, you know, trying to and wishing that we could, we're not like baking away saying, oh God, that guy, you know, I mean, it's just not, it's not quite that way. Like everybody's trying to design, you know, God, I wish we could design a Maserati body for our Ford. You know, it's not that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, San Francisco is well known for its sourdough. It's been written about, there's legends and stuff. What's your standard for a San Francisco sourdough? How can you explain that method or that style? What makes it so different than all other breads?
Oh, that it is. I mean, for us, we think, I mean, that's never been part of what our thinking is. Although I remember one time years and years ago, somebody from some biochemistry, you know, lab was doing a thesis on, or doing, you know, doing a paper on something, and they took some of our bread to do X-ray microcrystallography of it, and they informed us that we actually did have present in our bread lactobacillus. So ours was authentic San Francisco sourdough, and we said, well, that's whatever. I mean, because it's just never been it's just never been on our radar. Our goal has been to make naturally leavened bread, and within the scope of the techniques that we have learned and developed over time, to make that naturally leavened bread be as good as possible. Our standards for sourness have probably changed over the years. I think we're not necessarily as tolerant of really, really, really acidic bread anymore, and are more looking for a balance between acidity and an actual kind of rich sweetness that bread.
Well, I ask this to all my bread people that I speak with, and do you guys make German breads there?
Well, all our breads are made right here in Berkeley. We don't make bread in Germany, or some breads that are more in a sort of Northern European style. We make several different versions of Vollkornbrot type breads, you know, that are dense with whole kernels of rye and spelt, some with you know, pumpkin seeds and flax seeds, as I guess you might run across in Germany. A couple of other mixed grain breads that maybe are slightly more like a lighter German mixed grain bread. We've had lots of times where we thought, you know, where we thought what we wanted to do with production space that we had available was to develop specifically lines of, you know, heavy and dark rye, because we love those kinds of breads. But then, you know, it's like that product we're already doing, snapped up by stuff that went for that kind of bread, just hasn't been real strong. We make, you know, we sell some of them wholesale, but a lot of the rye breads we do are actually just things we sort of rotate through the week making just for our shop, you know, and people really like them. They have their devoted buyers. But there isn't a strong wholesale demand for them that we've.
Yeah, I think mostly it's French or Italian kind of loaves. I think people like.
Yeah. Yeah.
Darn.
Well, you know, we do make those kind of breads. It would be ridiculous for us to make more of them than people wanted and then throw them away.
Are you still actively baking?
I don't bake in production. I haven't baked in production for a long time. I sort of, that got the last sort of regular production baking that I was doing got kind of severed about 5 or 6 years ago when I decided to go back to school. You know, which I mentioned that my academic career had been abortive at one point, and about 6 years ago I decided I wanted to go back to school and study history and art history. So I became sort of a combination businessman college student. So, you know, that sort of, you know, kind of, you know, made official the gradual retreat from line production that sort of naturally happens with the owner as the business gets larger and has to run, you know, on the sort of efforts of others. I do a certain amount of you know, either experimental baking or baking special breads for special events, baking at home sometimes. But as far as actually filling a production shift, that hasn't happened for a while.
So you're a good case case scenario, I guess, of a home baker turned professional, because I talk to a lot of home bakers around the world, and so I'm just trying to make sure that can home bakers become real professionals?
Well, I mean, in my case, that was certainly possible. Although, you know, I mean, I was fully engaged in, you know, the food business also. So, you know, I wasn't just, you know, I was more thoroughly, I mean, I had connections within the food business. And, you know, I mean, I was working in a restaurant while I was a home baker, and then I sort of jumped from one train to the next while both were moving, you know what I mean? So that's
right.
A pretty easy step. But, you know, home bakers, I think, you know, when I first made the move into even baking for the restaurant, it was a big adjustment because, you know, you have to be able to deal with, I mean, even at the level I was baking at Chez Panisse, maybe, you know, a couple hundred loaves a day, you know, in a space that wouldn't accommodate a couple hundred loaves being handled at a time, you know, all of a sudden you have to set up an organizational system that, you know, is very different from your home, you know, from your home experience, if you, you know, where you might be making two or three loaves at a time. But there are home bakers now who have, you know, a brick oven in their backyard, and they bake 30 loaves, you know, 30 loaves at a time, twice a day in the same day, one time a week, and distribute it around to their friends. So there are, you know, certainly ways that people are making those transitions. But you know, I think just as with anything, once there are more people doing it, it's a little bit more challenging to get into it professionally.
And in starting a business like yours, what are the most important investments that you need when starting out, the tools, I guess?
Well, one of the things that really probably turned out for a wholesale bakery, one of the decisions, you know, that turned out to be probably really important to us in retrospect was to buy new trucks instead of used trucks. I mean, we could bake the best bread in the world, and you know, if it wasn't delivered on time, or if it wasn't delivered dependably, you know, nobody's gonna buy bread from us. And we just kind of, you know, for some reason we thought, oh, should we, you know, we could save money by buying a couple of used vans. No, we should buy new vans. And so, you know, for the first 5 years that we opened, we actually didn't have a single vehicle breakdown, which meant that we could, you know, dependably be a delivering functional wholesale bakery. Then it's when we opened our second bakery, we didn't occur to us how good that decision had been, and we felt like we needed more trucks, so we bought these used trucks, and they were always breaking down. It was like, oh my God, now what are we going to do? The truck's broken down. It's 5 in the morning. Is there a place we can rent a truck at 5 in the morning? So, you know, if we had started off at the very beginning, I mean, you know, the things that you do at the very beginning are so important, because it's kind of like, you know, you throw a pebble into a pond and the ripples emanate in all directions and get bigger and bigger. But, you know, but it all kind of emanates from that initial impact, you know, that initial thing that happened. And so for us, that was pretty important. That turned out to have been pretty important, I think, in retrospect.
So it's not always the oven that's the most important thing, I guess.
Well, hard to say. I mean, we bought new, you know, it's like the, I mean, it's certainly important. I mean, you've got to be able to bake bread in it, but somehow, you know, you're standing in front of the oven doing the same thing over and over again, and, you know, you've got, in a way, a little bit more control over it. You know, it's like you learn to know it. You can fix it yourself. I mean, the other thing that's really important is spare parts. We learned that really early on is, you know, it's usually not such so important that you, you know, the most difficult thing about making almost any repair in the bakery that we used to have to make turned out to be having the parts, not the difficulty of doing some complex task. So spare parts are also really important.
Yeah, I'm fascinated. I worked in a couple of bakeries just to get my hand to it and see what it was like. And I was always fascinated by how you have to get all the formulas ready. You have to, and then later on, I went to work at Amy's Bread a couple of times. And one night they put me on the late shift, and I said, "Wow, this would be great. We'll be baking." They said, "No, you're going to be bagging bread tonight." I was like, "What?"
Yeah.
I want to touch the loaves. And they said, "Oh, you'll be touching plenty."
Yeah.
So I realized that is a totally different side of the business that you kind of go, "Oh God, I never want to do that again."
Yeah. Well, it's certainly not what, you know, I mean, that's just one of the things that inevitably happens as a business of making something gets bigger is that it, you know, the things that were different parts of one person's job become the functions of whole groups of people that end up sort of specialized. You know, the challenge is to, you know, to avoid having that become a demoralizing kind of feature of your bakery. You know, to somehow give people enough variety in what they do and enough of a feeling that if they have aspirations to do something different in the company, that there are avenues for that, and also that, you know, that everybody understands that, you know, that somebody wouldn't be doing that job, whatever it is, unless it were really important. So that sort of set of jobs which are less, you know, sort of less crucial, that every, you know, ideally every position within the operation has got a value that everybody else appreciates and acknowledges.
Right. And how long do you think it takes to become a baker?
You mean how long does it take for us to train a person who comes in with the average amount of pre-existing skill, or not exactly sure?
That or from scratch?
Yeah. Well, lately these days, more and more people seem to have some experience. You know, started off, you know, that was pretty rare. You know, but within, I mean, there are two aspects of it. There's the aspect of learning to do some particular mechanical thing, like forming loaves, and then there's the aspect of kind of having a picture of how any given part of the operation, whether it's forming the loaf or baking the loaf or, you know, or bagging the loaf, fits into the whole process that's going on, and all the different stages of it are kind of going on simultaneously for a large part of the day. So, you know, it might take just, you know, a few weeks to train somebody to mold bread, you know, or a few weeks to train somebody to do mixing, but to really become a baker who really knows how to function within the bakery kind of independently and creatively, you know, 6 months to a year is kind of maybe how we think of it.
And what's the natural step or progression for a baker once he's reached a certain prime in one place? Do they generally go on to other places, or will they open their own bakery, do you think, or do you know?
A wide range, I think. Some people, we've had people do all things. I mean, we've been fortunate enough to experience demand for what we do that is strong enough that it was pressing us to expand kind of at the same time that we were developing within our company people who were likely to go out and start bakeries. So in four or five cases, people who you know, sort of had that kind of ambition and ability, have become part owners of our company, bought shares in our company as we expanded. So we have, you know, besides my wife and myself, all of the other owners of the company are people who have been bakers here and who then became part owners of the company. There are other, we have other bakers. There are bakeries in the area that have been started by former bakers of ours. There are bakers that we have who have had bakeries and then for whatever reason either, you know, either chose or had to close them down and have come back to work for us. So, you know, it's I don't know that there's any typical thing, but we certainly try and, you know, what we try to do is basically give everybody who comes to work here the benefit of the doubt that what they want to do is learn as much as possible about how to contribute here and to try to attach that as clearly as possible to the way their wages increase over time. And, you know, with the idea being that we're sort of trying to train everybody ultimately to become a, you know, an all-stations baker and to know enough to be a crew lead here. I mean, we don't have enough positions as crew leads for them all, for everybody to be a crew lead, but, you know, but that's our approach. And if people get that level of training and there isn't a position here that, you know, that takes advantage of that, then, you know, in some cases they may move to another place where they can, where an opportunity becomes available. But it doesn't really happen that often. People stay around here for a long time.
Yeah. Well, I kind of took up bread as a hobby. I work as a chef, but I went to the French Culinary Institute to take some bread baking classes, which was really wonderful. If, you know, you have three kids in the class and you're learning how to bake.
Yeah.
But then I went on to work at Boulet Bakery 1 month when it was slow at my job. After a 9-hour shift, I'd go in and work another 8 hours at their place.
What the heck?
And that really opened my eyes to how brutal a business bread baking is, even though it's the, I guess, the idyllic, you know, wow, I'm a bread baker kind of thing.
Well, when I first was going to work at, as a baker at Chez Panisse, I thought, man, this is going to be so great. I'll go in like at 4 a.m. That'll be kind of tricky to get up early, but I'll go in, like I'll form all the bread. Maybe I'll take my guitar and practice guitar while the bread's rising. You know, it's just going to be so mellow. And it didn't turn out to be that way.
Yeah, no time for the strings.
Yeah, no time.
Does anybody ever get used to the strange hours that bakers have?
I think so. You know, we don't, you know, it's not all of our, I mean, we have shifts kind of round the clock, and it's not the case that people who have the opportunity to move from a, you know, from a 2 a.m. shift to a, you know, to a 3 p.m. shift, for example, make to choose that. Whether they get used to it or not, I don't know. You know, it's hard to know whether they get used to it or whether it's got to do with, you know, whether they're just making choices based on what works best for their family. I know one of the things that we're trying to do with some expansion that we're doing here is we're going to try to shut down a part of the middle of the night, not really shut down the bakery, but kind of carve out a part of the middle of the night where nobody will have to come to work. It's to cut out sort of the most brutal middle of the night shifts by having enough, you know, sort of loaves per hour capacity that there can be a couple hours where nobody has to be really coming in to relieve anybody. Maybe the people who came in at 6 p.m., they'll still have to work till 2 a.m., but nobody will have to come in at midnight or 1 a.m. or something like that, so that we can try and get to a position where most people get to, go to sleep when it's dark if they want to.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I know. Waking up and looking out the window at 4 in the morning, it's kind of like, whoa, where am I?
Yeah.
What part of the day is this?
Well, 4 in the morning is not really a problem, I mean, for bakers. But what really turns out to, I mean, the thing for us is really if you have to try and go to sleep when it's light out. In other words, if you're going to work at 2 in the morning, that means, you know, you kind of need to go to bed by about, you know, 5 or 6 p.m., right? So, you know, there's a whole lot of difference between going to work at 4 in the morning and going to work at 2 in the morning. And there's a whole lot of difference between getting off work at 2 in the morning and getting off work at 6 in the morning. You know, because at least if you're getting off work at 2 in the morning, you can go home, relax, and go to sleep while it's still dark. Whereas you get off at 5 or 6 in the morning, you know, you're heading out, sun's coming up, and it's, you know, it's harder, especially if you've got a family to make that work.
Sure. Does that mean that you're retarding breads then at your bakery?
Well, we always, I mean, most of our breads, we don't really exactly retard breads in the sense of saying, okay, we're going to make up all this stuff and then just kind of leave it and then gradually pull it out. Most of our breads get very long fermentations.
Right.
But I think by having more proofing and baking capacity without necessarily having the requirement to increase production will just give us a chance to, carve out a little spot in the middle of the night where we can kind of slow down for a bit.
And do you guys ever take, like, stagiaires to come and work at your bakery?
You know, we've never really done that. And part of it is, I mean, we're lots of people come and observe and hang out for one, maybe two nights. But the thing about when what you do is so sort of routine and depends on, you know, happening according to a schedule, distractions can be disastrous. Because there have been people who have inquired about doing apprenticeships, there have been, you know, organizations who have inquired about placing apprentices, but because nobody can say, okay, yeah, we're going to always supply you with an apprentice so you can figure out what this apprentice will be doing and there will always be somebody there, then it's kind of like, well, so one Tuesday night there's going to be more than one person there? There's going to be, you know, one person extra? Then what effect is that going to have on a work crew that's accustomed to working in a certain rhythm, a certain pattern? People actually want to work, so, you know, it's not like, well, we're going to have an apprentice, so we're going to take advantage of that by sending you home early. You know, so it's never been something that we've successfully figured out how to deal with. I mean, it may be they're just overthinking it and it would work out fine, but the stakes for us in terms of making sure we avoid screwing up are too high. We're always figuring that almost, you know, under almost any circumstances we're capable of screwing up pretty badly.
Like forgetting the salt in the dough or something.
Well, you know, that happens for sure. But yeah, exactly. You know, if somebody's hanging out talking to the mixer, you know, and you get a batch of, 400 pounds of dough that kind of moves three quarters of the way through the system with no salt in it, you know, not that that never happens as, you know, already, but you increase the odds of it happening more often, then you increase the likelihood that, you know, that overall we become, you know, a worse bakery.
And where do you get your inspirations for new or specialty breads that you guys make?
It's, you know, there's a range. Sometimes you'll travel. Like, I know I went to the Terra Madre sort of Congress of artisanal and organic food producers in Italy and came across a bread made with spelt and rye bread and dried pears. Kind of a sourdough Levan type bread made that way that we started making, or it can be, you know, traveling and finding a bread that's commercially made. Sometimes it comes from a restaurant a restaurant that is asking about changing to a slightly different bread than something we already make. And if at that time we think about it and it seems like we can fit it into production and that it's kind of occupying that it's a bread that's worth making on its own and it's not really too much like anything else that we make, we might incorporate it that way. You know, so there's no one source of those kinds of those kinds of decisions and those kinds of impulses.
And when is your website going to be up?
Just a matter of time.
Oh, okay. I'm being very impatient.
What's that?
I'm very impatient because I want to look at your breads. I have to go out to California, I'm sure, to go try them.
Yeah, we have our domain name kind of held on to so that if somebody here ever does get inspired to produce a website, that we don't have to come up with some, you know, sort of funny version. But you know, we're just not quite sure what we would do with a website. You know, like what would be our what would it be that we would be trying to accomplish with it? We're just not sure. I mean, so
right. Well, I sometimes browse the web and go to like German sites because I love German bread and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I just go look at the pictures and go, oh man, bread porn, you know, like so cool.
Yeah.
And then I actually have this website that I go to. There, it's a bread form in Germany. And I've been kind of like being laughed at by some of the German bakers when I said, oh, you know, I saw this bread at this website, and they'll look at it and they'll go, my God, they're using like soybeans in that bread. What's wrong with you? Make it like real bread. So I'm like, uh-oh. So now they're challenging me. So I made a nice German bread. I made a nice German bread the other day with all just natural products. None of that, you know, processed weird soybean things that they can't deal with.
Yeah. Well, that's a good way to use the internet. We just haven't figured out. I mean, I guess we think of our company goal as very simple: to make the best bread we can and to deliver it to people who ask us to do that. And
right.
So we're just not quite sure what having a website would accomplish in the way of furthering that goal. I mean, it would be a nice thing for sure, but you know, it takes energy, and then it's a whole other set of decisions, you know. So it's like, do you want to put your time into deciding about what a website is going to be, or do you want to put time into figuring out, you know, whether you can put solar panels on the top of the new part of the bakery? You know, it's...
Uh-huh. Are you thinking of doing that?
Well, yeah, we actually are. We were really fortunate to be able to buy the building immediately adjacent to our bakery, and it's like it was a welding shop, which was really nice to have next door, but the guy retired and sold the building, and we're in the process of, we sort of did a bunch of seismic work on the building and cleared it out, and now we're in the process of getting a solar system put on the roof of it, and then in the summer we'll be converting the interior to production space.
Wow. And are you guys also organic?
All of our flour is organic. There are certain ingredients that we haven't found organic versions for, but all of our flour is organic.
So, Noel Comes made a funny remark about, because I was asking him to describe what bakers are, who the generally are in the world of baking, and he says, well, you know, it's kind of grumpy, retro hippie. So I thought that was, I thought retro hippie was pretty funny.
Retro.
Yeah.
I'm not sure exactly what that means, but...
I don't know. It's a weird Noel kind of thing, but I said, well, you know, it sounds cool.
Yeah. Well, there are certainly a lot of people... I'm a little younger than that era, but there's certainly a lot of people who, you know, thought of baking bread as a countercultural statement and, you know, and way to do something good that was, you know, do something industrious that wasn't like, you know, buying into the system, man. But I'm not sure how many, maybe if you say retro hippies, people who are, you know, young enough now to not really be...
Who want to be hippies.
Yeah, want to be hippies. Yeah.
Yeah. Great.
Maybe.
Well, yeah. Well, I'm going to have to definitely make a trip out there, and because there's a couple other bakeries I want to visit out there. One of the guys... My brother used to work with us, Pascal Rigo.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm going to have to go out to SF one of these days and visit you guys, because you guys are like icons out there. So
Well, doesn't feel like that to us, but you're welcome. I mean,
you were on Julia Child's show, and she's already an icon. So
yeah.
And how was that working with Julia? How did that feel for you?
You know, it was awesome. I have to confess that it was so unexpectedly awesome. It was, I grew up without a television. So, but my mom, you know, sort of, my mom was a great cook and had Julia Child's books. And, you know, if we were somewhere where there was a telephone, the television, you know, sometimes we would see the French chef. But, you know, growing up in sort of Berkeley in the 70s, you kind of get into this mindset of, you know, this kind of iconoclastic mindset, you know, sort of like questioning any, you know, old established figure, you know, probably is just, you know, full of themselves and inauthentic and, you know, a sellout and all that. But when she came to the bakery to, and I had met her, you know, at Chez Panisse when she was a customer and I worked there, you know, sort of, you know, peripherally, but I wouldn't say either of us knew each other at that time. But when she came to the bakery to scout, you know, for the show to see if she wanted to ask us to do an episode, she was so kind of right on, and none of this kind of, oh, isn't everything fabulous? Oh, what wonderful work you do. You know, she was looked at everything very carefully, and, you know, she said, you know, this, you know, she was critical of some things. She really liked other things, but she was just so focused and so, you know, clear about what she was looking for. And then, you know, doing the show with her, it worked out great because when we did the show, they wanted to do some kind of typical thing where you've got some bread baked, you've got some dough, you've got some starter, and so you fake it. You know, you say, okay, here's the starter, here's how you mix dough, and here's this, and here's how here's this, and then you put some loaves that you form into the oven, and then they turn off the camera, then you take some other loaves that you already baked out of the oven. But the bread we were doing, I realized, could be actually tracked from beginning to end through the entire shooting day. I did what they wanted. I mean, I made up all these versions of everything, and they were all, like, piled up in the background, all these pots and bowls of fermenting stuff. But the bread that we baked at the end was actually the bread that we mixed from starter at the very beginning. It wasn't long enough to use the, you know, to mix the pouliche on camera that we used to mix the dough from. It wasn't, you know, it's a, you know, an overnight pouliche. But ultimately, we baked the bread on camera while, and the bread came out great, and she was so accommodating of my wish to not do a sort of an ersatz, you know, chopped up kind of thing. And she was, you know, it's just so cool to see somebody, you know, she can't throw things around, or she couldn't at the time. She was still working, but she couldn't, you know, throw things around and really get in with her hands and do everything that she did before. So she figured out, you know, this different role for herself as the interested observer, trying to figure out what was not clear about what you were doing or what was interesting about what you were doing, and just kind of asking questions as you were doing it and really, you know, informing the viewer in a gentle and, you know, and still very, you know, personal way. I mean, it was still obviously her doing what she did, but through other people's hands, kind of. So, yeah, it was great. I really, and so unexpectedly, because I just imagined it was going to be, you know, such a frustrating and odd thing. But
yeah, because I was working during most of the shows, and my mom was going, "Oh, you've got to see it. This lady was making baguettes. It was incredible." I was like, "Oh, wow, that's so cool." Uh-huh. And then I happened to see your show, and then I said, "Oh, I'm going to try that." And then I finally got the book, and of course, I'm so lazy when I do bread that I just, you know, I never follow a schedule. I'm a good baker, but I'm just too lazy to really be. Yeah, it's bad. It's a really bad habit, and I'm like,
this book called The Lazy Baker.
Yeah, it would be good.
That would be excellent. Illustrated children's book of The Lazy Baker and all the weird things that can happen to him, you know.
Well, I've got this guy in England who gives me these recipe converters and formula things, because I've got, like, tons of recipes that I collect, and I just go, "Gavin, you got to send me something so I could do it on my Excel sheets, because I can't figure this stuff out. I'm so tired of these percentages." Yeah. And so he does. But, you know, but it works.
Yeah.
So now I'm getting better bread coming out finally.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just got to get my brain into it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Excel is really helpful for doing baker's percentages and scaling recipes and stuff.
Yeah. Well, I talked to this chocolate guy recently that I know here locally, and we were talking about how, you know, there's so difficult. It's so difficult to get trained people and skilled workers in the business. And I don't know. He said, "No, I don't know." He says, "I think it's an American mindset, and he thinks there should be an apprenticeship system like in Europe here." And I'm wondering if that's going to ever happen, or will it, or could it?
Yeah. Well, you know, there are people in the Bread Bakers Guild. I remember year before last at one of the big board meetings we had, and there are some people in New York. I think Sarah Black was. You know Sarah Black?
No, I don't.
From Chez Panisse. She worked.
Oh, right.
She worked actually with Noel very early on, And she and some other people from New York were working on a project to figure out how to develop a an apprenticeship, you know, some standards for an apprenticeship program to try to, you know, to get, you know, sort of establish the framework for people to use so that, you know, so that it would have some legitimacy and some value. You know, I think here in this country there's also, you know, maybe this sense that, well, you know, what exact position does this person play in my bakery if he or she is going to come there for 6 months and then is going to learn all this stuff and then leave, you know, because we don't have a two-tier, you know, pay system, and, you know, we're probably nobody's going to propose, you know, having indentured servants or something where you're, you know, working for, you know, scraps of bread. So, it becomes a kind of awkward within the modern labor system, you know, if you're going to pay somebody full wage for being there and depend on them, but you know they're going to leave, it's kind of not that tempting to hire them because it is hard, you know, it is hard to find people that you can depend on, or it takes time to produce people that you can depend on, you know, once they begin. So
I'm going to Europe again this summer, and I'm getting together with a bunch of people in England, in Wales, actually, in northern Wales, in this really small town. And a friend of mine, he wants to open a small bakery, and there's this guy, Dan Lepard. Have you ever heard of him?
What's his name again?
Dan Lepard.
I don't think so.
Yeah, well, he's kind of like the British bread guru.
Oh, okay.
And so he's going to be up there. So we got maybe like 20 people so far, and we're going to have our kind of our camp bread in Wales.
Wow.
So, it's in August, actually.
Oh, okay. So, we're going to be in England and Ireland, but earlier than that.
Yeah, that's when I have my vacation, so that's pretty opportune time. But it's cool because, like, this whole bread forum stuff around the world, you just hear about different ways to do things. I think bread is really coming back to what it should be, hopefully.
That's how I think of it. When people ask about, you know, some sort of renaissance or that sort of thing, I guess that's a legitimate way to look at it. But people talk, people think of it as something new, but I really think of it as maybe there having been, you know, a period of time between, like, you know, 1960 and 1980, where temporarily all the bread was kind of bad. But now everything's back to, you know, everything's getting back to normal, where you can get good bread if you want it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's good news.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Yeah, I hope
and,
you find something worth piecing together out of all that.
Oh, yeah, plenty of stuff. And I'll actually send you that really great German bread that I made yesterday, the formula for it, because it's really good.
Okay. What sort is it, a rye bread?
It's a half and half rye and wheat.
Uh-huh.
But it's called Landbrot nach Heidart, which I guess is a town in Germany somewhere.
Uh-huh.
I should know because I was born there. So.
Okay.
But it's a pretty nice loaf, and I'm just checking out this website in Germany, and they make some incredible breads where you just go, "Wow, look at that stuff! That's amazing."
Yeah.
And these are all like home. They're all home bakers, and you're like, wow, I can't believe this stuff, you know? Yeah. So it's pretty
Germany,
cool.
Germany, I guess, is, Germany's never really lost its tradition of having really good bread available by default everywhere.
Yeah. And we lost our Germantown pretty much here in New York City, so I miss a good pretzel. So I got to go visit my sister in Switzerland all the time for pretzels.
Well, it's a good excuse to go to Switzerland.
To go to Switzerland, yeah.
Yeah,
well, that's
tradition of
is to go write a book about the ladies who bake bread at home in their stone ovens.
Uh-huh.
So I did like a little piece on my website about this lady who does bread. She's a neighbor of my sister's, and she does it by hand in a big baby bathtub. It's really classic, and she grinds all her own stuff. It's pretty neat. Yeah.
Is that does that tend to be older people and dwindling, or is that something that's...
I'm not really sure, but in her village, it's this younger lady, and I met her, and I gave her the Jeffrey Hamelman book to look at that I gave to my sister, and she was like, oh, wow, this is so cool. Can I keep it for a couple nights? I'm like, yeah, sure, ask my sister.
Yeah.
But it's pretty cool, and she wants to go to learn how to make cheese in the Alps with some farmers, so...
Things are happening all over.
Yeah. Well, good. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And I'll tell you when it's on the web.
Okay, and yeah, I'd love to see that recipe.
Great.
Okay, thanks.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.